Hello, and thank you for joining me here at London's Royal Institution for a special edition of The Life Scientific, one that'll take us on a journey in space and time, through black holes and wormholes to giant experimental labs and Hollywood studios. My guest is Kip Thorne, Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Caltech, the California Institute of Technology, and someone who's had a huge impact on our understanding of Einstein's theory of gravity. An early fascination with the subject led Kip to break new ground in the study of black holes, and his work as part of the team that recorded gravitational waves for the very first time, the product of a collision between two massive black holes more than a billion light years away, earned him a share in the 2017 Nobel Prize for Physics. As if that wasn't enough, he subsequently took astrophysics to the movies, developing the original idea behind Christopher Nolan's time travel epic Interstellar, and since then, acting as the scientific advisor on various big screen projects, most recently the spectacular and highly acclaimed Oppenheimer. There can't be many physicists who've had a hand in a Nobel Prize and an Oscar, but Kip seems to have found a way to span those seemingly disparate universes. Perhaps there's a wormhole involved. Kip Thorne, welcome to The Life Scientific. Now, I mentioned the project that led to the first recording of gravitational waves, which then subsequently earned you a Nobel Prize. So can I ask you to set out in basic terms what they are?
Gravitational waves, you can think of as ripples in the shape of space that are generated by things like colliding black holes or the birth of the universe and travel at the same speed as light does, bringing us detailed information about their source.
And, of course, they were predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity.
Einstein conceived his general theory of relativity. I prefer to call it his general relativity laws because it's not a theory without basis. In 1915, and within about 6 months, he used his general relativity laws to predict gravitational waves.
Incredibly, though, it took a whole 100 years before they were actually confirmed to really exist.
Indeed, because it was so very, very difficult.
Well, we're going to hear a bit more, Kip, about the project that finally was successful in detecting them. I also mentioned the movie connection, and we're going to come back to that too. But in your experience, how concerned is Hollywood about getting the science, or in your case, the physics right, versus telling a good story?
It depends on the director. It depends on the movie. I love many movies that are what you might call science fantasy.
Right.
But for hard science fiction, serious directors like Christopher Nolan are very concerned about getting the science right. Though in Chris's case, when we agreed to collaborate, I said to him, I hope that you will agree that nothing in the movie will violate well-established physical laws. And his response was, I am enthusiastic about that as long as it does not get in the way of making a great movie.
Fair enough. I guess a biopic like Oppenheimer is different because it's history, not science fiction. In terms of your advisory role on that movie, I guess it must have also helped that you knew J. Robert Oppenheimer personally.
Yes, it did. In fact, I was the only person that Chris ever met who knew Oppenheimer. I was the only one old enough.
Okay, let's explore how old you are, Kip. Let's go back to the start. You were born in June 1940 in Logan, Utah. What was it like growing up in Utah?
It was an idyllic childhood. This was a Mormon town, but I grew up in a family with one foot in the Mormon church and one foot out, and so it was a very interesting growing up.
Your father was a professor of soil chemistry, I believe, at what's now Utah State University. Tell me about him.
So he grew up on a farm. He actually matured and became a real man with real intellectual interests by serving on a mission for the Mormon Church, coming to London and preaching the Mormon gospel in Hyde Park.
just down the road from here.
And he described to his children how he was often heckled by the same person. And so he would go off to a pub with this guy who would heckle him, and they would argue and talk philosophy. They became fast friends, and the whole process of interacting with the outside world, having grown up on a small farm in rural Utah, that was a tremendous thing for him to really learn about the world and get a broad view
Your mother also hoped for a career as an academic, but Utah state laws at the time put a stop to that.
That's right. Now, she had a PhD in economics, one of the very few women of that era, but she was not allowed to teach at the university because my father taught there, and there were what they called nepotism laws that said that a spouse couldn't teach. And so she became a community activist instead.
And she wrote a book called Leave the Dishes in the Sink, Adventures of an Activist in Conservative Utah. She gave talks about the importance of bringing up children to think creatively. I wonder, was that something that you were the eldest of five, so you and your four younger siblings, were you aware of that?
We were very much aware of that. We were being encouraged to think for ourselves.
It was around the age of 13, I gather, that you decided physics was the path for you, especially after discovering the great physicist George Gamow's book, 1, 2, 3, Infinity.
Yes.
Wonderful popular science book. With rather lovely symmetry, some years later, when you were a published researcher, Gamow then got in touch with you.
Yeah, so I had published a paper, and he wrote to me and asked me some questions about it. And I responded and said, well, I'm in this because of you. I read 1, 2, 3, Infinity 7 times. And he, by return mail, sent me a copy of 1, 2, 3, Infinity in Hungarian, inscribed with, to my dear colleague Kip Thorne, so he would not be able to reread it.
Very good.
Well, back to your teenage years, Kip Thorne. You mentioned the church. You were brought up in the Mormon faith. But as a teenager getting into science, your religious views did start to change quite significantly, didn't they? And was that a difficult time for you?
It was not difficult for me as it was for a number of my friends who also went a similar route because of the family I'd grown up in, because of the way I'd been taught to think for myself. Mm.
I gather years later, when your mother was quite elderly, she encouraged the whole family to resign from the church.
Yes, so there was an issue of discrimination against women. There was an amendment to the American Constitution called the Equal Rights Amendment. The Mormon Church had come out very strongly against the Equal Rights Amendment. And as a result of that, largely, my mother encouraged us all to leave the church.
Well, in 1958, you headed off to university to study physics at Caltech. How did you find it there?
I had a rough time for the first year and a half. I came out of this small high school. I had not had calculus. Most of the other kids had had calculus in their schools. And the other thing that I found was that almost everybody else's brains worked faster than mine. So I realized that if I was going to really make it, that I had to learn things more deeply with my slow brain so I didn't have to revisit them later on to relearn them. So I developed my own strategies for doing that.
Seems to have worked out since, anyway.
Yeah.
I should say that amidst of all this hard work, during your third year at university, you married your first wife, Linda. You're divorced now, but you've remained close friends. In fact, I gather Linda and your two children with her accompanied you and your current wife, Carol Lee, to the Nobel ceremony a few years back.
Yes, we are very good friends. And the journalists in Sweden were quite taken by the idea that here's this guy who comes out of Mormon background. He brings two wives and two children.
You put them straight, presumably. Okay, Kip Thorne, back to your studies. For your PhD, you applied to Princeton, which at the time was the leading center for research in the area that you wanted to focus on, general relativity, which, of course, as the theory gives us our most current and most precise description of gravity and space-time. But back in the early 60s, general relativity wasn't a fashionable subject. So what was the attraction for you then?
I had fallen in love with this at age 13, reading George Gamow's book, 1, 2, 3, Infinity, and then following my nose and reading other things. And so I was just totally excited by the idea of warped space and time, and that could somehow be responsible for gravity. And I wanted to understand this.
Mm. Well, Kip, after completing your PhD in 1965, you went back to Caltech, and that turned out to be a very productive time for you, didn't it? Gathering a team of researchers.
It was wonderful. I arrived at Caltech at a time when the great, most exciting area of physics was high-energy physics, or the theory of fundamental particles. but it was in the doldrums. It happened to be at that time. And so there were a number of really brilliant young budding theorists who had gone to Caltech planning to work in elementary particle physics. And here comes this young kid out of Princeton full of ideas for work in relativity, where there was a huge burgeoning. It was the beginning of what I like to call the golden age of black hole research. And so as a postdoc, I wound up running a research group that had 5 graduate students and several postdocs myself, so they couldn't do anything except give me a professorship.
Well, not bad by the age of 27 Caltech. That's pretty good going.
It was a different era than the present era, and Caltech is a different kind of institution.
Of course, the 60s, as you say, was a golden period for studies of relativity. This is in part thanks to a series of remarkable astronomical discoveries. Quasars, pulsars, cosmic microwave background radiation. We don't have time to go into all of these, but they all involve relativity theory. The main thing to say is that the theme throughout your career has been the importance of collaboration. And around that time, you were building connections to some of the world's leading authorities in the field in relativity, including an extremely influential group of researchers in Moscow.
Yes, and I had studied Russian as an undergraduate, took 2 years of Russian, with the expectation that I would be working in an area where the Russians were really strong. And so I began traveling to Moscow for collaboration very soon after I got back to Caltech.
And you're collaborating with them in particular in the study of black holes.
Yes. There was a leader of the group there named Zeldovich, who together with Andrei Sakharov was the father of the Soviet hydrogen bomb.
And Sakharov, of course, we now know more as the Nobel Peace Prize winner, the dissident.
Right. Yeah. And he became a dissident. But when I asked them, why did you build the bomb? When they agreed, they knew that the Russian regime was not a very healthy regime. They said, we were scared to death that the Americans would do a preemptive nuclear strike on us if we didn't have nuclear weapons too. And so they built a bomb, Zeldovich and Sakharov being the theorists who designed the bomb. But they had both turned their attention to astrophysics at that time. So I built a collaboration with Zeldovich's group, and they had the idea that X-rays were coming from disks of gas around small black holes. So they started using Newtonian gravity, building models for these disks. And I was exposed to that in Moscow, and so I just jumped on it. This was the first of many situations where I got ideas from the Russians, and so I focused in on building fully relativistic models for the disks around black holes, which really do play a major role, we now know, in astrophysics.
Right. Time to get into gravitational waves and the science behind that first detection. Set the scene for me first. It's now the 1970s. What's the thinking around gravitational waves at this point?
So Joseph Weber, a very creative physicist, had designed and built a gravitational wave detector and thought he saw gravitational waves, but he actually had not. And a number of other groups built detectors and didn't see the waves. But Ray Weiss at MIT had invented a new, different type of gravity wave detector, which is the type with which we ultimately had success. I was very skeptical. It took me 3 years to become convinced that his design had a real shot at success if we worked very hard for several decades. And I made the decision. This was so important for the future of science that I would devote most of the rest of my career and that of most of my students to trying to help the experimenters succeed.
Well, in 1976, you asked Caltech to fund a research project dedicated to gravitational wave experiments. They backed you. Your new research group started building a prototype by 1984, LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory.
Let me just say that we built our effort around Ronald Drever, whom we imported from Glasgow.
Right.
And Drever and I and Ray Weiss then founded this LIGO project.
And it took a while. In the early 90s, you finally got approval to begin the construction. By the time it really gets going, we're talking about hundreds of scientists in an international collaboration. And at that point, you decided to take a step back from day-to-day involvement.
Yeah, so it grew to 1,000 scientists. We brought in Barry Barish to lead the effort, a superb leader and organizer. But by about 2004, I felt that the younger generation of theorists that I had trained were just as capable as I was of doing the things that theorists needed to do on this project. I got concerned that we didn't have an adequate capability to simulate collisions of black holes, because I was fairly sure the first thing we would see would be collisions of black holes, and we would not be able to understand the waves we saw unless we had computer simulations of the collisions. And so I built at Caltech a research group working on that in collaboration with a former student of mine at Cornell, got the simulations working robustly and fast enough to keep up with the data as the data came in, only a year or two before LIGO saw the waves. So it was sort of nip and tuck to get that done.
Wow, just in time. Well, it was early one morning in September 2015, the team made its first direct detection of gravitational waves. Do you remember hearing the news?
Oh, yes, I remember very well. I woke up that morning. I had an email from Christian Ott, a young professor at Caltech. And Christian said, go look at such and such a website, an internal LIGO website. We might have a detection. And I went and looked. And the data were too good to be true. I couldn't believe this was real. And it took several months to be absolutely sure.
Not only, of course, did that discovery confirm Einstein's theory, it opened up a new way to look at the universe, because everything we know about space, we know because capturing light, electromagnetic waves. Now there's a different kind of waves that can tell us what we're seeing.
That's right. In fact, that was motivation from the very beginning for me. Our goal was to do what Galileo did for gravity waves.
Yeah, yeah. And that's yet
and
to come.
We did, and this team of 1,000 people pulled it off. And the Nobel Prize should have gone to the team. It only went to 3 of us.
That is, I guess, an issue people have with the Nobel Prize, because 2 years later, 2017, as you mentioned, it was awarded to you, Ray Weiss, Barry Barish. A journalist described it as an announcement that surprised no one.
Yes, so I got the call at 2 a.m. in the morning in Pasadena, and the guy at the other end said, it will not surprise you that the Nobel Prize is being awarded to you, Barry Barish, and Ray Weiss for this. And I said, it doesn't surprise me at all, but I'm very disappointed. It should have gone to the entire team. And he said, we'll discuss that when you get to Stockholm.
Okay, we now come to another chapter in your professional life, Kip, taking physics to the movies. I want to start by traveling back in time, if you'll forgive the analogy, to the late 80s, when you were encouraged to start thinking about wormholes by none other than Carl Sagan.
Yeah, Carl Sagan called me up. He was a dear friend. He said, I have this movie Contact that I'm working on and a novel that will come out before the movie does. He said, but I have my heroine traveling through a black hole to get to the vicinity of the star Vega. He said, I think I may be in trouble. Can you help me? And I said, yes, you're in trouble. You can't go. If you go into a black hole, there's a singularity, and you're going to die. So you should use a wormhole instead. But I said, the trouble is that wormholes are unstable. They implode before you can get anything through. And so I thought about it and very quickly came to realize something that it turned out other people had discovered, a guy named Gannon had discovered before me, that the only way to hold a wormhole open is to put inside it something that anti-gravitates. And if it is to anti-gravitate, it has to have negative energy. I came to call that exotic matter. So I told him, you've got to fill your wormhole with exotic matter, then maybe some very advanced civilization has built this and can hold it open. And so he rewrote big pieces of that novel, which his publisher was not happy about.
The other thing that you and your group then realized very quickly is, of course, a wormhole doesn't just join two points in space, but two points in time.
Suddenly,
you've got something that can act as a time machine.
Yeah, if the two mouths of the wormhole are at places where time is flowing at a different rate, one of them may be just near a black hole, for example, and the other one is out in intergalactic space, it will immediately become a time machine. And so if you have the technology, converting a wormhole into a time machine is dead easy if you have the technology.
The theory's all there in place. Yeah. And of course, all this stuff really laid the groundwork for your own first foray into film. Tell me about Interstellar, how that came about.
So Linda Opes, she had been Carl Sagan's primary producer on Contact. After Carl passed away, she called me and said, would you like to brainstorm with me for a movie? And I said, yes, absolutely. This should be fun. And maybe we could make a movie that will inspire young people to get interested in science. So that movie became Interstellar.
Mm. And of course, it got taken up, I think, first by Spielberg and then Christopher Nolan.
Yes, and because the movie began with Linda and me, we built science into the fabric of the movie from the very beginning.
I mean, it is remarkable that there's nothing there that breaks the laws of physics. That's what's wonderful. And of course, this was the start of a beautiful working relationship.
Yes.
You later helped Chris Nolan on the physics of his sci-fi thriller Tenet.
Yes.
And as we alluded to earlier, you advised on Oppenheimer. In fact, you advised Cillian Murphy on his portrayal of Oppenheimer.
It was just a great joy working both with Chris and with Cillian on that film. I was not deeply involved, just at a very modest level. But they are both so talented. And the movie is a masterpiece. Mm. And I'm very proud that I had this small role in helping make it.
And of course, if all of that wasn't enough, you have just published an illustrated book of poetry as well.
Well, I would put it a little differently, that it's a book of tightly integrated verse and paintings. The painter, Leah Halloran, and I created the paintings and the verse jointly with a give and take. It was enormous fun. I have enormously enjoyed these collaborations with people in the arts.
Well, let's go briefly back to your science, Kip. You were part of a massive step forward for astrophysics and our understanding of Einsteinian gravity. What's the next leap forward in physics, do you think?
Well, the one that I am most excited about is to try to understand the birth of the universe, how it was born, what went on in the Big Bang singularity, as we call it, and simultaneously to come to grips successfully with the laws that governed the birth of the universe, which are the laws of what's called quantum gravity. These quantum gravity laws, we have some indication of what they might be. The best approach to them, I think, is what's called string theory or M theory. And they have been the holy grail for theoretical physicists for decades and still are. And that's going to happen somewhere around the 2050, 2060 timeframe when we have new technologies and new gravity wave detectors. And I'm just tremendously excited about
it's
this.
It's interesting because I've never heard anyone predict a date for when that might happen, 2050, 2060.
Well, I was overly optimistic on LIGO, so maybe I'm overly optimistic here.
And what's next for you personally? I hear you might have another movie idea up your sleeve.
Yeah, well, Stephen Hawking and Linda Opes and I initiated another movie close to 20 years ago now. It's died 8 deaths. Now, a cat has 9 lives. I'm hoping it stays alive this 9th time. But if this movie dies, I'll turn it into a novel.
Okay, good. So, no plans to slow down just yet?
Oh, no. Life is much too interesting. There's too many really interesting things to do and to learn about.
Wonderful. Well, listen, Kip, I'm going to turn it over to the audience here at the Royal Institution to ask you some questions. The hands immediately shot up there.
My question's about exploring the interior of wormholes. If you do manage to make a wormhole somehow, where is the interior of the wormhole? I'll just add that I asked Lenny Susskind the same question, and he said, maybe it's an abstract formal space, and then said, maybe it's in Brooklyn. So, where is the interior of the wormhole? Or does the question not even make sense?
I prefer to think of the wormhole as being embedded in a higher dimensional space. And it doesn't have to be that that's the case. The higher dimension doesn't actually have to exist. But I would be a little surprised if wormholes can exist. I'd be a little surprised if the higher dimension doesn't exist. And so I just think of it that way, that the wormhole is embedded in this higher dimensional space. You ask, where is the throat of the wormhole? Well, It's in the higher dimensional space between the upper sheet and the lower sheet.
There's a movie, isn't there? I can't remember who it is who says, look, this is what a wormhole is. It takes a piece of paper, folds it over, and punches a pen through it. Now, that's says the paper is two-dimensional space, and the pen is the wormhole.
Yep, that's Interstellar.
That's Interstellar.
And that is the character. That's a character named Romilly, who's an astrophysicist and goes on this trip, and dies on the trip because a robot named Kip explodes and kills him.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask, so you worked on a project which obviously was very challenging at times. So for the people who are now maybe starting out their careers who want to work on quantum gravity, as you were talking about, the next big thing, what was the one piece of advice that you'd pass on to the scientists that are starting work on this now?
So I would put it in very general terms. If you want to do something that's very difficult and have it make a real mark on the world, you really should pick something that's a lot of fun. In fact, it was my grandfather who gave me this advice. He said, Kip, when you grow up, if you find a job that's like play, you will be a success.
Thank you. I think that's probably all we have time for, unfortunately. Huge thanks to our wonderful audience here at London's Royal Institution. And, of course, a big thank you to today's guest, Kip Thorne. Thank you very much for sharing your life scientific.